Thanks. So I have organized this this talk to be a review of what we know of the state of the art of GRB observations. I mean, I don't think I will go too deep in any issue, and in particular research I'm doing right now. I will try to overview the field, first of all. Okay, so everybody knows that the most sensitive instrument which has studied GRBs so far is BATSI. It's the longest lived mission on GRBs, and it has detected nearly 3,000 gamma ray bursts during its nearly 10 years mission. The most important finding, the first finding of BATSI, was that gamma ray bursts have an isotropic distribution, and this is true also if you divide the two classes that we know GRBs are subdivided into, long and short GRBs. If you take these two classes separately, they are still both very highly isotropic in the sky. If you compute the dipole and quadrupole of this of GRB's distribution, it's consistent with zero. And this was the first strong indication that gamma ray bursts must come from extragalactic. In fact, not only extragalactic, but cosmological. I mean, they come from very high redshifts. Another important finding of BATSI is that gamma ray bursts are divided into short, into long. The majority of bursts having durations peaking around 20 or 30 seconds, and short bursts, or also called subsecond bursts, because most of them have durations less than 1 second, and there is a clear minimum at 1-2 seconds between these two. Oh, you mean because there is this putative third soft short class? That's not highly significant, right? I mean, there is much debate on that, but yes, yeah, that's right. To first approximation, there are two classes, and there is a claim that there may be a third class of soft short bursts. You see that. This subdivision, this bimodality, is mirrored. Does not only concern durations. It's mirrored in the spectral shape. It's not a very strong effect. But you can see there is an effect that short bursts are averagely harder than long bursts. So there is a. The conclusion, there is a strong belief that the two classes must be short and long bursts must be different, must have quite completely different progenitors. And we now know quite confidently that long bursts are associated with supernovae, and there is increasing evidence that short bursts are associated with the mergers of compact stars. So this is a historical slide. This is the first detection of an X-ray afterglow for a GRB. This is a Beppo-Sachs detection. These are Beppo-Sachs images obtained with the X-ray telescopes. The location of a gamma ray burst, of the burst of 28 February 1997, a bright, previously unknown X-ray source has been found with an X-ray telescope 8 hours after the explosion. And 3 days later, the source was much fainter, was almost gone for the sensitivity of this instrument. And clearly, more quantitatively speaking, this was the temporal behavior. This is the event, the prompt event in X-rays. This is an upper limit obtained with the wide field cameras on board Beppo-Sachs, which are the localizing instrument. And this is the first target of opportunity observation, the detection of the X-ray afterglow. And this is the second point, 3 days later. And this is a further ASCA point. All of these X-ray points lie on a power law, temporal power law, of index minus 1.3, meaning that it is a rather fast, rather rapid decay. So this first example gave to the astronomers, to X-ray astronomers, the idea that this game must be done very fast. This follow-up must be very fast, because afterglows are very fade out very rapidly. And the same happens in the optical. This is the first historical detection of the optical afterglow of the same gamma ray burst by Jan van Paradijs. This is the point source. OT is the optical transient, the point source at the position of the gamma ray burst. And 1 week later, it is gone. And 6 months later, it is gone for a 4 meter telescope. But 6 months later, HSTC still sees it. This is the host galaxy. The nebulosity here is the host galaxy. And the white point here at the outskirts of the host galaxy is the afterglow, still visible, still detectable to HST 6 months later. And after the detection of afterglow, this was the first one. We now know about 200, perhaps 150 afterglows. And for most of them, for a large fraction of them, a redshift has been measured. So the redshift measurement was the proof that of the extragalactic origin of these objects. This is a slide, a summary slide of redshifts. These are not all of the redshifts we know now. We have measured. There are measurements for many more GRBs than these, but it would make putting all of them in the same slide would make it very crowded. So I decided to leave it as it is with only a fraction of the GRBs for which we know redshifts, and I have highlighted the four GRBs for which we have a supernova association. A supernova association is relatively reliable, and the four GRBs with short duration for which a redshift is available. Perhaps there is a fifth right now known at 0.5, which is not plotted here. And there is also the highest redshift known so far, 6.29, about here. This is a swift gamma ray burst detected on 4 September. And the redshift has been measured by several groups, including the Japanese Subaru Telescope group. So this slide, this plot, indicates immediately one of the biggest paradoxes, apparent paradoxes of GRBs. So this is the gamma ray output during the prompt event in the y-axis. And as you can see, energies, gamma ray energies, can reach, observed energies, reach up to 10 to the 53, 10 to the 54, and over erg. We know that gamma ray bursts originate from stars. Whatever the kind of explosion is, they must be stars, because the variability of the gamma ray emission is very fast. So the variability timescales are very fast. Light crossing times are very small, so sizes must be stellar sizes. So whatever produces gamma ray bursts, it's a star. And so this slide would imply that these stars are converted almost 100%, so with a one efficiency, to electromagnetic energy in gamma rays, which is of course a paradox. So these observations of huge energies, of huge gamma ray outputs, was the first indication that GRBs are not isotropic sources, are not emitting spherically, but they must have jets. The evidence of jets is indirect, is mainly linked, mainly related to the light curves of the afterglows. This is a typical case for which the presence of a jet has been claimed based on the shape of the light curve. The idea is, this is this is the optical afterglow. This is a very bright, famous gamma ray burst, 990510. The afterglow was very bright. The afterglow first decays as a power law, as I've shown before, for February 28. But at some point, it steepens. The light curve steepens at all wavelengths. And the same happens in the X-rays. The steepening of afterglow light curves has been interpreted as a proof of, of the presence of a jet. Namely, the idea is that at some point, the deceleration of the plasma in the jet causes the Lorentz factor of the plasma to equal the inverse of the opening of the physical opening angle of the jet. At that point, the observer is causally connected with one edge of the jet and starts seeing the edge of the jet and then and starts missing light from the afterglow. So this increasing light missing is reflected in the steepening of the light curve. So people have also ventured computing opening physical opening angles of the jets from the time of the steepening, from by computing the time when approximately the steepening occurs. And these openings are about a few degrees, from few degrees to 10 degrees. Of course, nobody knows exactly what's the physics, what's the structure, mainly the shape and the structure of this jet. There are various ideas. There are jet models, uniform jet models with rather defined, rather clearly defined borders, edges, and universal structure jets, jets which emit in all directions, but the Lorentz factor is a function of the angle. The one of the so an independent confirmation of this picture is given has been found in 2003 for gamma ray burst 030329, which we will discuss later because it is important for the progenitor issue. This is the polarized light curve of the gamma ray of the afterglow, the optical polarized light curve. The decrease of the polarization percentage in coincidence, simultaneous with the detection of the steepening of the light curve, has been considered an independent proof that the steepening is due to a jet, independent proof of the presence of a jet. I mean, jet models predict that you have a decrease of polarization after the steepening, after the temporal break, after the break of the light curve. So this is a scheme of the a rough scheme of the jet. We have here a collapsing body, which in some way forms a jet and a counter jet, and in the shorter, closer to the engine, the internal shocks in the jet, the disturbance, the hydrodynamical disturbances propagating in the jet give rise to internal shock, internal shocks and to formation of gamma rays, and then the interaction of this of these internal shocks with the external medium, with the circumburst, with the circumstellar medium, produces external shocks and the formation of an afterglow at all wavelengths. This is the rough picture, which is the basis of the most popular model for gamma ray bursts, the fireball, or renamed the fire cone, because a fireball it's a symmetric event, it's a symmetric geometry. Instead, if there is a jet, we likely have something like a fire cone. The Lorentz factor, the plasma is flowing with a high Lorentz factor at the beginning during the prompt event, and the deceleration by the time the afterglow forms, the afterglow starts dominating, starts to be prominent, the Lorentz factor has decreased to 10, about 10. So the given that we know or at least we have this strong evidence of the presence of jets. The question is what produces jets, how do they form, what are the objects originating jets. One of the first evidences emerged after especially in the optical studies of gamma ray bursts, is the association of gamma ray bursts with star formation. The first evidence came from the host galaxies. These are two typical spectra of two GRB host galaxies. These are the typical lines found, detected on optical, on hosts, optical spectra, the Balmer series, oxygen 3, oxygen 2, and very important, neon 3, which is a very high ionization line, indicating the presence of conspicuous temperatures. The detection of these lines indicates that there is an ongoing strong star formation. Of course, they depend, especially oxygen 3, oxygen second, is a particularly favored line due to the typical redshift of these objects. As I've shown before, redshifts of gamma ray bursts go from very low. There is one, a particularly low redshift. The highest one is 6, but as you see, most of them are clustered around redshift 1 or 2. So in the optical studies, the oxygen 2 line in host galaxies is particularly favored for detection with optical spectra. And okay, this is a review of some of the most representative host galaxies. This is one of the most beautiful. It is a face-on spiral. The position of the gamma ray burst is this green circle, is indicated here. This is a redshift 0.8. This is a very regular host galaxy. This is the white spot here is the afterglow, the point source. The complex here is the host galaxy. It's not very clear what the morphology is. It is clearly an irregular object. It is irregular. I mean, the high redshift, the redshift is relatively high. So at these redshifts 1.6, you find a lot of objects like this. I mean, it's common to find irregular sources, same irregular galaxies. This is also a host galaxy belonging to a very complex system. It is not clear. It is not obvious to distinguish the morphology of the galaxy. This is an example of how frustrating can be the search of host galaxies. This is a tiny host, redshift is 1.6 again. I think this is one of the, or probably the faintest host galaxy ever detected for a gamma ray burst, 28.5. And this is a disk, this is an edge-on, nearly edge-on disk. Relatively nearby. All of these studies, of course, have been done with space telescope. The best observations of hosts are done with space telescope. You can judge it also from the level of the magnitudes. Sorry?
Those journeys, are they
long? Yes, all of these are long. Yes, I will show later an example of a short host. This is a color magnitude diagram of GRB hosts. I'm very sorry. This is the V minus H color. Some of the slides have there is a cut on the left, and some of the slides are severely affected by this. Anyway, this slide is to show, to give an idea of how blue are the colors of GRB host galaxies. These five big dots here, big blue dots here, are GRB hosts. And they are compared, their V minus H and H magnitude are compared with the same quantities for a sample of galaxies taken from the Hubble Deep Field. The colors indicate various ranges of redshifts for these HDF galaxies, but, and the black dots must be stars. And you see that GRB hosts are as blue or bluer than any galaxy in the HDF, regardless of redshift.
What did you say, the black dots? You said the black dots must be...
Sorry, the black dots must be, yeah, these must be stars. These are not very significant. This plot has been done by putting everything in a certain HDF. It's extracted from the HDF sample, and there is everything. It's a mixed bag of objects. So back to the oxygen second line, since it is so relatively easy to detect it on host spectrum, this is a summary of the best measurements. This slide is relatively old, so at that time there were the number of hosts known and well studied was lower than at present. So these big dots here, there are I think 8 big circles here, indicate the equivalent width of the oxygen star of the oxygen line for 8 GRB hosts compared with the same quantity in a sample in an HDF, in the HDF. The equivalent width for GRB hosts is relatively high with respect to the sample. The star formation rates extracted from from this oxygen line are relatively high, although not exceptionally high. However, when compared with the star formation rates measured derived from radio and millimetric observations, the optical star formation rates are always very low, appear always very low, which indicates that they are highly extinguished. At times they are very extinguished. The millimetric star formation rates are huge, are very exceptional, up to 500 and even more. I think there are samples, there are objects, the host galaxies which reach 1,000 solar masses per year of star formation rate. Metallicities are not very well studied for these objects because it's not easy. This estimate, 0.004,000 solar, is from the 3 lowest redshift hosts that we know, and it is very low. The GRB hosts have generally low metallicities. They have blue colors. They have usually compact shapes. They are mostly irregular, also due to the high redshift, and they have low metallicities and high radio star formation rates. So,
when you say low metallicities, are you referring to just one or two lines, or is it like low metallicities consistently across all? Because I know lots of them are very irregular, sort of.
There are various estimates. There are different estimates. You can estimate the metallicity in various ways. It has been done systematically in a serious way only for two objects, for two lowest redshift objects, which are the hosts of 98.0425 and 0303.29. For those these order of magnitude metallicities are reported, which is very low.
I have a question. You said these millimetric star formation rates are high, but I saw that was only in a few cases. So in many cases, you don't see much millimetric.
That's true. Yes, exactly. In those cases, millimetric observations have not been done for a high number of objects. Yes, it's true.
But also for the ones where they have been done, they have not all been detected in the
millimeters. Oh, so there are only upper limits.
This very high rate. I'm told that was only in
Yes.
So up to 10 solar masses a year is quite the norm.
That's true. There are, yes.
1,000 solar masses per year is not the rule, is not the norm. Yes, my message, what I wanted to say is that can be, that's the highest bound, the highest bound of the range. Yes, yes, of course, thanks. So there is from the studies of from the multi-wavelength studies of hosts, of GRB hosts, there has been an evidence has been gathered that there is a link between gamma ray bursts and star formation, that these hosts exhibit conspicuous rather high star formation, and in some cases very high, exceptional star formation rates. There is a closer, an even more direct example of relation of link between GRBs and star formation, which is this very bright and well-studied burst of 4 October 2002. This was a very bright afterglow. Spectra have been taken at several telescopes, especially at the big telescope at the Hobby-Eberly and at Keck. This is the Hobby-Eberly telescope spectrum, and the claim of these authors, and same has been found by Mirabal with Keck, is that on the spectrum they detect absorption systems at different redshift with respect to the redshift of the host. The host is 2.328 redshift Z2.328. There is you can see here some lines at slightly lower redshift, especially 2.291, and in this spectrum the most evident line at lower redshift is 2.291. in the Keck spectrum they find another couple of absorption systems. These redshifts indicate velocities of few hundreds kilometers per second with respect to the rest frame of the host galaxy. And these authors interpret these systems as due to a shell radiatively accelerated by the gamma ray burst, and due pre-emitted and pre-enriched by a Wolf-Rayet star, emitted by the pre-existing Wolf-Rayet star and enriched by the wind of the star. So they consider this the presence of these blue shifted with respect to the host rest frame absorption systems is considered an evidence of the presence of the of a massive bare star previous to as possible progenitor of the gamma ray burst. This is the only example, the only clear example. I don't know of any other so detailed spectrum of another clear detection of these blue shifted absorption systems. So the most direct link between evidence of link between gamma ray burst and star formation and massive star formation is obviously the detection, the simultaneous and co-spatial detection of a supernova with a gamma ray burst, which is the famous case of 25 April 98 and supernova 1998 BW. This was a type 1c supernova, and it was anyway peculiar among type 1c's. It's not a normal object. These are the light curves compared, the five light curves in UBVRI compared with the V light curve of a normal type 1c. 94i is here in the bottom, and the top five are the BW light curves. But most important is the spectrum, of course, of BW. You see it in the top, and it's compared with two spectra of a 1b, a 1c and a 1b, considered normal 1bc's, 84L and 94I. And the features, the absorption features of 98BW are the same. One can identify the same species, but the velocities are very different. The width of the lines is very different. BW has much broader lines than the so-called normal type 1BCs, which is, of course, evidence of higher than normal velocities and higher than normal kinetic energies. So in 2003, another similar example has been detected in in association with the GRB 030329, a supernova 2003 DH has been detected. You see here the series. There have been many telescopes observing this object, which was a Haiti gamma ray burst. The optical afterglow was rather bright. It was a close by, rather low redshift object. And this is the series of VLT spectra. There has been a monitoring lasting for more than 1 month. And these are six spectra. The top spectrum is a pure power law space described by a simple power law, which is typical synchrotron, typical for synchrotron radiation, is a typical afterglow spectrum. But as time elapses, you see that the power law disappears and there is some other component emerging underneath. And the bottom spectrum, compared with the spectrum of 98BW at a similar epoch, is remarkably similar. So there is evidence that there is a supernova component, a supernova profile underlies this optical afterglow, and it is increasingly evident with time. Here you see, on the top, you see an attempt to reconstruct the light curve of the supernova by decomposing the observed spectra from the afterglow component. You take the observed spectrum, you take a simple power law decaying with time, a power law spectrum whose normalization decays with time, and you decompose it, you subtract it from the observed spectrum, and you obtain the supernova fluxes, the supernova flux with time. As you can see, the errors, especially at the beginning, are huge. So this decomposition job is not easy and is probably not reliable. Unfortunately, the epoch at which it is most unreliable is the early epoch, so that the rise of the supernova cannot be studied, cannot be evaluated very precisely. This point here has no meaning. I mean, it's basically an upper limit, so it has no, it is of no use to constrain the rising part of the supernova, unfortunately. However, you can see some, you can deduce, at least you can make some deductions. You can take these six or five points and put a 98BW light curve template. And as you can see, it's not a good fit. It doesn't match. So it looks like this supernova, this 2003 DH, supernova underlying this burst, does not evolve with time as 98BW, which is the continuous, the thick line. So it must be, although it is very similar spectrally, spectroscopically, the temporal behavior is a bit different. So we have attempted to take the 98BW light curve template, and we have shifted it back in time by 7 days. So we have assumed that the supernova explodes 7 days before the GRB. This is the dash, the long dash here. And the fit is better. It's probably better, as you can see, except the last point. However, it is not consistent with the spectra, because the spectroscopic evolution of DH coincides with that of 98BW. I mean, the spectra, the same phases are similar. So it is not spectrally speaking, the assumption that supernova 2003 DH exploded 7 days before the GRB is not consistent. So we've tried a third attempt to fit the light curve with the template of 98 BW compressed by a factor of 0.7. And this seems to fit better, and seems to be better justified from a physical point of view, because the idea is that since you see a strong GRB, 030329 was a strong GRB, and you see the supernova, you must see the supernova along the if the supernova is asymmetric, you must see the supernova along the direction of maximum asymmetry, since you have seen the GRB. So you must have seen both GRB and supernova along the axis of symmetry. If this is the case, if this is the geometry, the mutual geometry of the observer and system, it is conceivable that the supernova evolves, rises, and declines faster than normally, than 98 BW, than an object seen at a bigger viewing angle. This is an interpretation. It has been interpreted. It can be interpreted in different ways. You can reproduce a faster behavior also by changing, by assuming different mass and energy than assumed for 98 BW. The Paolo Mazzali and the group of Ken Nomoto have, in fact, modeled 2003 DH with a lower energy than 98 BW, and lower explosion energy and lower mass, lower nickel mass. And here you see a comparison of the photospheric velocity. This is to give you an idea of the velocities, of the expansion velocities of the photosphere, this bottom panel. The dots are the photospheric velocities measured with the silicon line. And compared, the line here is the same quantity, the photospheric velocity of 98 BW. So they are very similar. At the beginning, you see that the early expansion velocities can be very high as 1/10 of the velocity of light. And then there is, of course, a decline, which is very similar in both supernovae. So these velocities indicate a very high kinetic energy. And this is the third well-known, well-studied case of association between supernova and gamma-ray burst. GRB 03-12-03, this is an integral gamma-ray burst associated with 2003 supernova 2003 LW. The detection process has been the same. The light curve exhibits a rebrightening, and there is these are the spectrum, the two spectra at two near maximum, December 20 and December 30. The GRB exploded on December 3, so these two spectra near maximum. As you see, the redshift is rather low. Of course, you need low redshifts to make accurate studies of these supernova spectra, of these GRB supernova spectra, because otherwise, at high redshift, you are swamped. Your signal, your optical signal, is swamped by the spectrum of the afterglow. So the supernova simply does not emerge. The dashed lines are the 98 BW templates at the same phases. Yes, at the phases similar to December 20 and 30. There are some more questionable cases. So I have illustrated three cases in which the association between GRB and supernova is considered very firm, very clear. 98 BW, supernova 98 BW, 03 DH, 03 LW. There are some more a number of more uncertain cases in which the evidence of supernova is not spectroscopic, but it is only photometric. It is like, it appears like, this is a sample, a typical case. It appears like this. There is a light curve of afterglow. You detect an afterglow, you follow its light curve, and at some point you detect a rebrightening. And at this point, the epoch of the rebrightening is generally consistent with the maximum of a supernova. This is a typical case for an X-ray flash. X-ray flashes are gamma ray bursts, which are particularly rich in the X-rays. Namely, they have, you know, that gamma ray bursts are not only gamma ray sources. Gamma ray bursts have multi-wavelength prompt counterparts, X-rays, optical. So the prompt X-ray flux of X-ray flashes compared with the gamma ray flux with the simultaneous gamma ray flux is very high. The ratio between X and gamma of the prompt event is very high, and in those cases you don't call it a GRB, you call it an X-ray flash. That there is a continuum of properties. There is evidence that they are not a separate population with respect to GRBs. They are the same. They are just much softer. So this is the observed light curve. Here at the right, you see the light curve. You see this rebrightening with an afterglow subtracted, and you see a template, a dashed curve, which is the template of 94i, which is a normal supernova 1c. It is not a hypernova. It is not a powerful hypernova. This template, this light curve template here, is that of a normal 1C supernova, and it has been we have modeled it. Nozomu Tominaga of the group of Ken Nomoto has made models for this bump, for this supernova light curve, with different models. And he has found a low quantity of nickel mass, of ejected nickel mass. I think one-tenth solar, 0.1 solar masses of nickel, which is consistent with having a normal supernova. This is very interesting. So it looks like supernovae associated with normal GRBs are very powerful, a powerful supernovae, supernovae with high nickel masses, namely 0.3, 0.5 solar masses of nickel. X-ray flashes may be accompanied by weaker, by normal supernovae. Not, you don't need a hypernova to make an X-ray flash, perhaps. We don't know. This is a very suggestive case. This is another case. I reported here another case of an X-ray flash at redshift 0.25, so relatively low redshift, in which Alicia Soderberg has observed the afterglow, subtracted an afterglow power law component, and found a residual which she has compared with 98BW. And the claim is that the 98BW spectrum is a good match. As you see, the signal to noise is very limited here. I don't know what's the significance of this. It is as you can see, that it is limited, of limited significance. But this would be a counterexample. In this X-ray flash, 3 September 2002, the putative supernova component seems to be matching the spectrum of a hypernova.
In the calcium line sector, so the blending isn't as high as the BW spectrum. Seems to be
okay. Room for debate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. There is the probably the afterglow light curve, just few points, but no reconstruction of supernova light curve. Now that's a very difficult job. It's very, very hard to do because you need many spectra and a very careful subtraction.
Yeah,
close without even interrupting. I can make a comment about
yes.
the C4I. We all call it normal, me too, a normal type 1C. But it's because it was a very well observed type 1C, but photometrically its light curve is the fastest type 1C light curve I've ever seen. It's at the tail of the distribution.
I see.
It's the lowest energy, lowest everything else. By no means normal.
In a system, normal. Not normal.
For core collapse, not for 1C.
1C is normal.
The light curve is the fastest.
Yeah. So you mean the rise and decay are very fast.
Up down the middle of one C is the extreme.
So it can't be considered typical, in fact. It's not a typical.
There's no such thing as typical one C.
So the question we have asked, so we've seen association between GRB and supernovae, particularly very powerful supernovae. We've seen this clearly in three cases, and perhaps in four or five cases in a less clear way. In nearly all of these, the supernova is powerful. Namely, it has large kinetic energy. It is a hypernova, as it has been dubbed. I should say that hypernovae, namely supernovae, as powerful, as energetic as 90 APW, have been detected, but not accompanied with GRBs. Once 98BW has been detected, has been studied, there has been a study, an archival study in retrospect, and more attention in the subsequent studies of 1C supernovae, and many of these hypernova-like objects have been found in the archives and in new observations. Examples are 97DQ, 97EF, 2002AP, and so on. There are quite a number of known powerful supernovae which are not accompanied by a detected gamma ray burst.
Any question about the 297 supernovae?
Yeah.
Do you know what was the Bazzi position, the Compton position that time?
In
on the other side of the Earth, or?
It looks like a GRB has been searched for in these cases, not only by Bazzi but also by the IPN. I mean the combination of Bazzi with other satellites. It's never obvious. There is no obvious gamma ray burst detected in that area of the sky around the time of the supernova, which means a rather generous window, temporal window, has been explored, namely from 1 month before and 1 month after the supernova, and there is no obvious object. The point is that you can never rule out an association, because there are many objects, many events for which an accurate position, not detected by Bazzi, for example, detected by other satellites, but for which you cannot triangulate.
Okay, I think my question was wrong, because Bazzi could be on the other side of the Earth. So
but
we don't know exactly the GRB time.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Exactly. The idea I've tried to do this search system a bit with some systematicity with Kevin Harley. The answer is never pure. It is never certain. He can't rule out. He has the tens of potential events. He cannot rule out all of them, because he hasn't precise, sufficiently accurate positions for all of them. So you can never rule out an association. There is no obvious one. There is no tight angular association. there are many, many objects in the vicinity.
So if there's special supernovae that's seen, How certain can you calculate the time when the GIE
depends on how well you know the light curve of the supernova.
But Elena, 1998 BW, if it had been at a normal redshift, say, of 0.1 or 0.2,
yes,
it would not have
seen
the gamma ray burst.
Of course, yes.
Because it was a very faint gamma ray burst.
Yes.
We only saw it because the supernova was
very nearby. These are the stars that double, so you would.
You are
in the same sort of situation.
Yeah,
They are fairly nearby.
These
you have to postulate only 45
Yeah, 90. These are below 100 megaparsecs. These are all below 100 megaparsecs. Okay. These. Okay. These are 2002 AP is 7 megaparsecs, is very close. In order to identify spectroscopically an hypernova, you need a close-by object.
Okay, but if they are so nearby, if it had been a normal gamma ray burst, it would have swamped all the detectors.
Unless it is.
Like
misaligned.
Unless
it's misaligned.
Unless you have no afterglow at all.
Yeah. Unless you have no gamma ray burst.
Yeah, but
if it would be as bright as say OC 29, which was at redshift 0.17, it would have swamped all the detectors.
If pointing, yes.
And another thing is, all these were discovered the supernova, not as gamma bursts.
Yes.
So there's no gamma.
Yeah, so my confusion here is, they can be misaligned and then you wouldn't see it, but then in the radio, at least when I talked to Tree, he says he would see
it. that's the big issue.
What's the situation?
I'll say some more.
There is only one detected in the radio, which is 1998
BW.
No other one ever.
Yeah. I'll say some more on this. So
the three good example gamma ray duration.
Oh.
The duration ray longers.
Yes. No doubt. 25 April was about 100 seconds. The 29 March was. I'm sure they were all over 10 seconds. Yes. Yeah. Although the shape, the profiles are very different. Time profiles of the gamma ray, of the three gamma ray bursts are very different. 25 April has one single. Unfortunately, I don't have it handy, but has one single peak. 29 March has two bright peaks, and the 1203, I think, has one single peak as well. That's weak in gamma rays. It's intermediate. It's an X-ray rich. It's intermediate between X-ray flash and gamma ray burst. But the profiles are very different.
Well, for the first figure, you had four blue circles and four green.
Yes.
So they were very close.
That's maybe okay. It for long GRB. Okay. So I may go back just a minute to that slide. I can find it quickly. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. For the purple, for the GRB supernova objects, it's a selection effect, of course, because you can't see supernovae at redshift 1, because there is a, you detect afterglows at redshift 1 if they are very bright, namely if the GRB is closely pointing to your direction. But in that case, the relativistic aberration enhances the luminosity of the afterglow and makes it swamp the supernova light. So it's very hard, just for relativistic effects, to detect supernova at redshift 1.
In this picture, you cannot see any difference between short and long
time. Of course, yes. This picture, short GRBs for which a redshift has been measured are few, are not as many as long. Generally, the redshift of short GRBs is small, is below 0.5, 0.7. And
selection effects.
I don't know. This I don't know. I don't know. Okay, it's a selection effect because short GRBs are less energetic than long GRBs at comparable redshift. What I don't know, so for sure we don't detect short GRBs easily at high redshift. What I don't know is if the population of short GRBs is as numerous at low redshift as the long GRBs. I mean, short GRBs, there is evidence, in fact, that short GRBs are detected more frequently at low redshifts than long GRBs. So there may be an intrinsic effect of higher rate of short GRBs at low redshift than long GRBs. Although, I don't know, I mean, we start to have this evidence, but I don't know how significant it is. Perhaps one needs more higher numbers to quantify this.
For unit volume, there are more short GRBs, but they're fainter, so there is a selection effect. It's, they appear less numerous, but because they are less bright.
What I observe is that in the last year, Swift has detected, let's say, 10 short GRBs for which there are five or six redshifts. And all of these redshifts are low. So this doesn't happen for long GRBs. This is what I'm saying. Yeah. This is what I'm observing.
It was predicted a year before Swift. So many people predicted this.
The high abundance of low redshift short GRBs, yeah. So it is expected that short GRBs are more frequent.
Theoretically, but in the wrong meeting, many people talk about this. They expected lower shift short bursts.
And that's based on the PETSI data?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Only.
I think based on their
beliefs.
Beliefs. Yeah.
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 That's not certainly.
Most people.
But now it comes up.
So yeah. It's kind of science.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the point I wanted to make about I should resume it from here. Okay, so what another piece of evidence? It's not a piece of evidence. It comes from a computation from an estimate. The rate of GRBs roughly corresponds to the relative rate of hypernovae to the total number, said more simply, the number of hypernovae corresponds roughly with the number of GRBs, with the reconstructed number of GRBs. If you count GRBs, if you take into account beaming by taking a value 500, typical average value of 500 for beaming effect, this reconstructed number of GRBs coincides roughly with the number of hypernovae, which is about 5% of the totality of 1C supernovae. So one would expect that, roughly speaking, there is one GRB per hypernova. So do all hypernovae have jets and produce GRBs? But we don't see them all, because most GRBs are misaligned with respect to the line of sight. So this is like a unified scenario, very similar to the unified scenarios for radio galaxies and blazars, for AGNs. So can we test the idea that all of the more powerful supernovae produce a gamma ray burst? And we observe many hypernovae, and for a fraction of them, for the beamed fraction of them, we observe also the gamma ray burst, which is pointing toward our direction. Here is a summary, a family of curve of spectra of supernovae to show the diversity, the spectral appearance, and the different width of the lines of the absorption features in the various cases. 94i with very narrow widths, 2002 AP with broader width, 97 EF, which is another hypernova, broad width, and 98 BW, the broadest features. So these features, of course, are accompanied, are reflect different increasingly high kinetic energies. There is a an observation which favors the aspherical aspherical geometry of supernovae, of hypernovae, but also of normal supernovae, and it is this asphericity may be the key to the formation of the gamma ray burst. Of course, you need an asymmetric object to form jets and to possibly form a gamma ray burst. So there is an evidence of this lack of symmetry in nebular spectra of supernovae. We've heard about the nebular phase of supernovae yesterday from David Branch, and it is on nebular spectra that I would like to concentrate right now. You see this green spectrum here on the top is the observed nebular spectrum of 98 BW, namely the spectrum of 98 BW taken some months after the explosion of the supernova. I have highlighted two lines, the iron line and the oxygen line, which are modeled here with a purely spherical model for nebular supernova emission. Clearly, the model does not fit. It's not a good match. The blue and red is the model. It has been tried by the group of Ken Nomoto, Maeda. This is a paper by Maeda, who envisages that the supernova explosion is not symmetric, but there is the two regions form. A central, more confined region, jet-like, in which most of the iron is produced, and a bigger equatorial region in which the oxygen is produced. This this model generates an asymmetric geometry for the supernova explosion and a confined nucleosynthesis. You have different regions for different nucleosynthesis, for different formation of for the formation of different elements. If you apply this aspherical model to the spectrum of nebular spectrum of 98 BW, you see again here on the bottom the same spectrum in green, the nebular spectrum, and the modeled iron and oxygen lines using this asymmetric scenario. And you see that the match is much better, is good. So this model, this match is obtained if you assume to observe the object with a viewing angle of about between 15 and 30 degrees with respect to the axis of symmetry. And it is, in fact, you obtain a good approximation of the lines. So we have asked the question, what happens if you look at this modeled object, that this if you are in a scenario, in a confined nucleosynthesis scenario, but you look the object at a much different angle, not 15 degrees, but I don't know, for example, 70 or 90 degrees, I mean more equatorially. With the, what happens if you're viewing is more is aligned with the equator rather than with the asymmetry axis. And we have started an observational program with Subaru to test this idea, this scenario. And this is the object I want to highlight, that I want to talk about, the 2003 JD. This is a hypernova. It has been detected on 25 October 2003. It is rather close by, 80 megaparsecs. It is compared here with other supernovae, and it appears to be intermediate. Its spectral behavior appears to be intermediate between normal, let's say, and narrow and broad, very narrow and very broad absorption features. It is as luminous as 98 BW. It has broad features. It is an hypernova, not accompanied by a gamma, not obviously accompanied by a gamma ray burst. The observations, these are the spectra in nebular phase, taken 1 year after the explosion of the supernova. There is one spectrum taken. We've taken one spectrum with Subaru and another one with Keck. Here is the Subaru spectrum on top. And the oxygen, zoomed on the oxygen line. The oxygen line appears very different from the oxygen line of 98 BW. In 98 BW, the oxygen nebular line was single peaked, and it was modeled very well by the aspherical model. And here you see a double peak, which the model follows, reproduces very well for an angle, for a rather wide angle, for a rather big angle of 70 degrees. So it looks like it looks like 2003 JD is an object you are looking in this scenario down in this direction, very close to the equatorial direction. And obviously you have a big oxygen distribution, equatorial distribution, of which you see the receding and the approaching sides as a double peak in the oxygen, a red and blue part of the profile. So this is the summary of the prediction. You have an explosion with preferential views, with preferential ejection for iron and for oxygen. Iron ejected in this direction, in this jet-like direction, and oxygen in the equatorial distribution. If your orientation is along the jet, the symmetry of axis, you see a single peak for the oxygen line and a double peak for the oxygen line if you are oriented in perpendicularly to the jet. So in this scenario, if this is the correct scenario for hypernovae, as Chris was mentioning, you should be able to observe a gamma ray burst when your line of sight is aligned with the jet, with the, let's say, I don't want to call it jet, this is not strictly speaking the jet, is the axis of symmetry of the supernova. Most likely, if the supernova has the energy to form a jet, the jet is to produce a relativistic jet. The relativistic jet comes out in this direction, of course. So in this case, if your line of sight is this one, you should be able to observe a gamma ray burst, if one is produced. If you observe perpendicularly, so if you have a 2003 JD line of sight, you don't observe any gamma ray burst, because this would be oriented perpendicular to your line of sight. But as Chris was pointing out before, you should be able to observe an afterglow, because the afterglow is not as strongly, as severely beamed as a gamma ray burst. Afterglows are more isotropic, or better, they are relativistically aberrated at the beginning, but then they isotropize very much because the plasma decelerates. And this is the situation. We have taken models for X-ray and radio afterglow expectation at different viewing angles. In blue, you have the expectation for radio afterglow at families of radio afterglow light curves for different angles, and X-ray models, X-ray expected light, synthetic light curves for the same viewing angles. And we have compared the X-ray and radio upper limits obtained from observations of 2003 JD, and we have noticed that while the X-ray upper limit is compatible with the X-ray synthetic light curves, the X-ray upper limit is between 25 and 45 degrees, which is compatible because our estimate is 70 degrees. Our estimate for the viewing angle of 2003 JD. In the radio, we don't have the object has been monitored for nearly for 1 year and a half. You see here the radio upper limits. The last point is not is only marginally compatible with the radio synthetic light curves. So it seems to be only marginally compatible with the expectation. There is not total consistency. And more recently, last summer, the group of Sri Kulkarni has completed a survey, a radio survey of a number of type 1c supernovae, including six hypernovae. And they claim, they report upper observations, detections and upper limits, they claim not to have detected radio emission for the particularly for the six hypernovae, which are black dots here, and the double circle is 2003 JD. They claim that these are the upper limits, and none of them is consistent with expectations of radio afterglow models at any angle. They've tested two scenarios for radio afterglow expansion, wind and uniform interstellar medium, and wind circumburst environment. They've taken a standard jet with 10 to the 51 erg. They've taken standard a jet with standard under standard conditions with different medium expansion. They claim that the upper limits are not compatible with any radio afterglow model. So this is a problem. I mean, this is where we stay right now. It looks like the nebula spectra, the optical nebula spectra of supernovae, of hypernovae, are consistent with this asymmetric scenario for supernova explosion, which would also account well for gamma ray burst formation and detection. However, the radio of the independent proof offered by the radio survey, by the radio observations of hypernovae, is not supporting this scenario. So we have here many questions. Is the model are these models for radio afterglow correct? Is it correct to assume that radio source, radio counterparts really isotropize? We should really expect them to be detected at some point? Are the jet assumptions correct? We have this problem. I mean, the problem is not solved.
So when they say they do a wind model, I assume it matters what your mass loss rate for your wind is as well. What were they using for the mass loss?
I don't know what they assumed. Probably they assumed a standard value like 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5 solar masses per year.
Because the reason I worry is then we say these things are in low metallicity environments and the Wolf Rayet wind will be a lower rate. And then my question would be, are they ruling them out for that kind of wind? I just don't know what they did for their analysis.
I guess they usually start from the 15, which is a standard one for them.
Yeah.
So if you had a lower piece, if you went on a factor 10,
what that would do to their models?
Yeah.
So the scale
will
go down.
Yeah, it's going to go down. I just don't know how much.
Well, nobody knows. I mean,
the wind mass loss rate. How does this constraint change?
I think one order of magnitude would would start making things consistent.
Yes. I didn't want to ask that.
Yeah. The problem is that when you try to fit normal after normal GRB afterglows with these models, these are the when you try to use wind models, these are the mass loss rates.
Only ever know that the metallicity is low, if I got you correctly, in the nearby supernova GRB cases.
Those are
logical GRBs, you have no indication.
That's right.
Yes, you have. Yeah, because they have very low dust, and that must mean that there is.
So you've got a problem.
It's also at the high redshift, they have very low metallicity.
But those are fitted like that, kind of. With a standard A star for a star, which means a normal metallicity, vis-a-vis low metallicity.
I think all of them have, the most galaxies, one very basic characteristic of all of them, I think there are 37, so it's very low metallicity. No dust, which is quite amazing, actually.
That's true. Remarkably, in a high number of afterglows, you don't see a very high absorption in the optical spectra, which are rest frame UV.
So
they are not very dusty. The environments are not dusty.
Couldn't the gamma ray burst have destroyed the dust?
That's an issue. Yes.
I saw there was one case where there was evidence that the dust was destroyed in But it's very essential, I think, for making models for why stars produce, why certain supernovae produce a gamma ray burst and others don't.
Yeah.
Maybe the low metallicity has something to do with it.
Yes. Yeah. No, I wonder. I would be curious. For example, I wonder whether I wonder what would be the results if one fitted all afterglows with a wind model and a low mass loss rate, with mass loss rates one order of magnitude lower than these, for example, because afterglow models have many parameters, are fitted with many parameters. So I really wonder what's the freedom.
The energy would have to go up in the cases where you have a lot of energy. If you take A star down,
yes,
you would not have to do this for these, because then you go back to where you came from. Because you want to get rid of it. So because this thing's in graph, something that bumps into something else, it's now going to split that up somehow.
Yeah. There is also the issue that for many
these are the weak GRBs, yeah.
There is also the issue that for many high redshift GRBs a wind model doesn't seem these wind models don't seem to be An ISM model seems to be preferred in most cases.
Right, but the density is not high.
The density is not high. Yeah.
Well, so I saw this one paper by Xavier Chevalier, one of the wing guys for the afterglow, trying to fit, and they said it's easier to fit it with a low mass loss rate wing if they want to try and stick with the wind model rather than the ISM model. Well, if everything is pushing us for low mass, mass loss rates, well, maybe that's the answer, and we should be.
But it's also true that a lot of these radio bikers have been fitted with a normal sort of ejector, ISM or wind matter interaction. That was also the high energy
difference.
Is that the winds are all, in fact, we recently are working with Davide and Rodalba, and we published a paper on 2.1004, but we think the winds are really strong. if the winds are clumped,
well, that's been
known for Yeah, so that's exactly, and they're saying that, you know, from the spectra, you can prove for O21004 that they are clumped winds. And if you can, then that makes a difference out here. The second thing is that this goes on for 10,000 days or something, by which time the shock, it might have crossed the termination shock, in which case that part of the spectrum doesn't mean, that part of the light curve doesn't mean anything at all, because it's from a completely low density medium. The thing after that is that this is assuming like a radio survey. I mean, how do they fit the radio curves? Like, do they just take an isotropic expansion, assume a magnetic field in a certain direction, and assume like how many particles are there? Kind of
assumption. In Shree's world, they use a religion.
That's the I wonder how correct and accurate are these radio models, these synthetic light curves. I mean, how realistic they are.
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on what parameters they use. And we don't know what kind of magnetic field, what protection, what kind of relative, how many relativistic particles are different in
themselves. My other guess is that. The radio may be beamed, may stay beamed. Maybe the radio emission may be beamed as well as the
I'm talking about 10,000 days.
That's about 100 days.
Oh, well, like, no. Yeah. It goes all the way to the end. It's crossing like over a thousand, few thousand maybe. So you're talking like maybe 10 years or so? That's the
thing
for me. I'm presuming. I mean, I got some models of Bulbray winds, models around environment around Bulbray winds, and by 10 years or so, you should be expected it's going into it. I mean, it depends again on the mass loss rate.
Yeah, and the termination shock actually moves in if your mass loss rate is lower.
Yeah, but actually it depends on what happens before.
Yeah.
I think David.
I have a naive question about the slide where you showed the Wolf Ray features in the rest frame UV spectrum of a host. Why is there a spectral signature there that says Wolf Ray A, or is it just some assumption?
It's their guess.
It's not from the spectrum.
It's bubbles. Moving bubbles. But I think shocks moving, which you would get from a Wolf Ray star.
Okay, so it's 200 kilometers per second.
That's right.
Well,
yeah.
It's more than a few thousand.
It's few.
But the shell doesn't move at a few thousand or even a few hundred.
No, there are two systems. With Keck, they find three systems. Two are at few hundreds kilometers per second, and one is of the order of 1,000.
The Wolf Ray doesn't come from any particular spectral signature.
It's just
line. It's just a shell.
Yes.
Anyway, the frequency range, if there was more than 10,000 kilometers, so it was 5,000. It's 0.035.
That's a lot.
I saw there was one more case recently where they also similar. So there's two cases.
It must have escaped me, but yeah, okay. I may look up. It would be interesting because,
The spectrum is D=6 GRB.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there is some indication in the blue sheet. Right? It could be a Wolf Ray share.
That's a blue sheet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So one point that you can notice here. Is in a Wolf Ray model, in the wind model, you expect to cross the wind termination shock after about a few days, or 10 days. And then what you look like, and then the afternoon would look like, is if it's consulting to cross some low density. So.
You expect to cross the wind termination shock in 10 days?
Yeah, the reverse, there are two shock waves.
No, you don't expect, never.
The reverse shock.
Yeah, it's pretty far up. It's a few parsecs.
No, the forward shock is a few parsecs.
I know, I'm not going to reverse it. I know, I have lots of models of which I'm doing. The wind termination shock is
same parsec. The wind termination shock should be at around 1 parsec. And it would observe, you would question in observe time, since running to review of a few days. Of course, you know, the real time. Because of the Lorentz induction. Of course, the real time would take a few months. But you'd seen it on the timescale of a few days.
May I ask a question?
Yes, sure.
So,
the idea of radioactive, it's come from, you see a gamma ray burst, you know, and then you follow it up in the radio and you see some radioactive, right? So there must be some average properties of radioactive glows of objects that you say are gamma ray bursts, that you detected versus gamma ray bursts, right?
Yes.
There should be some average luminosity of radioactive, right? So it's already calibrated, right? If you were trying to test this unified model, this jet axis model, the luminosity of radioactive glows is already calibrated.
Yes.
From previous observations.
Yes.
So you should just be able to, so if the unified model says every hypernova has a gamma ray burst, then we should see some radioluminosity coming from these six hypernovas.
Of course.
And maybe you could say, it's this wind or that wind or it's clumpy or whatever, and then the only hope you have is that they're peculiar, that these six are peculiar, which it seems unlikely because they're six.
For sure. The distances of these hypernovae, which do not exceed 100 megaparsecs, you expect radioluminosities to be huge. I mean, not radio brightnesses, to be huge. And you don't see them. You don't detect bright radio flux. My point is this, does this necessarily lead to an inconsistency, or our synthetic, like our expectations, wrong? Do we know that these radio off-axis models are correct?
Well, what we just said is correct. It seems that hypernova, yeah,
and if there's any kind of angular dependent thing, and you're modeling in such a way to try and get it back, the issue is if your models are wrong, then that can be your expectation.
But the radio emission after late time should be roughly as we thought.
That's the claim.
Right. And if you're testing this jet axis model and saying, if the jet axis model is associated with a hypernova, then...
I mean, there is, as we were discussing, there is...
The only time you actually see right here is when you see the gammas.
So the gamma ray bursts that have been associated with hypernova
are there not any supernova of whatever kind, when you don't see the gamma, when you see the radio, there should be, depending on your mean action, there should be lots and lots of those.
That's
you see none.
But they always say when they're pointed at the...
But when you point at the these two, both gammas are right here. And why is that?
What that's saying is that the jet axis afterglow internal shock, external shock model is not jiving with the hypernova.
Of course
it's not surprising, because the hypernova that are associated with gamma ray bursts weren't typical gamma ray bursts, or your classical long duration, so on and so forth.
One point may be that not every hypernova makes, but our estimate that every hypernova.
For 1990, I'm not so sure it's as true for the other two. O3 is also very weak. Gamma rays, I thought it was more like normal.
It's not a weak. The D-beamed gamma ray emission is normal. If you correct the gamma ray output of 29 March for beaming, that's a normal. That's not exceptional gamma ray burst. It's intermediate. It's normal. Normal gamma ray burst. Yeah. So I think I have Swift results, but since it's already, I don't know, it's already 11:30 and we are having Neil Gehrels as a guest, right? So he may illustrate Swift results. I don't know, it's...
So Neil Gehrels comes in 2 weeks, is that right?
Yes.
graphically generate. Some people might be
stupid. Yeah. So, well, okay, this is Swift. It's been launched more than 1 year ago. And this is the localization. These are the three instruments on board Swift, the gamma ray instrument, the XRT, the X-ray telescope, and the optical telescope. And the localization capability of the BAT is very good. BAT detects and localizes gamma ray bursts to arc minute precision, and XRT follows them up immediately, and XRT follow-up starts automatically and detects an X-ray counterpart and localizes it to less than arc minute precision. So this is a very fast and accurate process of GRB detection and localization. Swift has detected so far 100 gamma ray bursts. It detected the 100 a few days ago, and only for 20-25% there are optical UVOT counterparts detected. Most optical counterparts are detected from ground, because UVOT is not a terribly sensitive telescope, although it has the important ultraviolet capability. So when it detects a gamma ray an optical counterpart, it gives an important contribution. This is a collection of X-ray light curves detected so far by XRT. The important new thing is the early part of the light curve. The previous generation of X-ray satellites used to detect X-ray afterglow starting from here, 10 to the 4 or 10 to the, yes, between 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 5 seconds. I mean, it was technically impossible to detect afterglows before this epoch due to the localization time, repointing of the satellite. Swift does this immediately and detects these very bright early portions of the light curves, and there is the general trend is that it is very fast and it gets shallower around 2,000, 3,000 seconds. Here is another important feature of consequence of the Swift rapid capability of detecting and localizing gamma ray bursts is the capability of detecting optical counterparts. The very fast localization of a gamma ray burst is relayed very promptly to any telescope in the world. So robotic telescopes come into play and have done a very great job with detecting simultaneous optical flashes, optical counterparts of gamma ray bursts. Here is a particularly important one. Detected by Raptor, which is an automatic telescope. The optical flux has a very similar behavior, is very well correlated with the high energy flux. Unlike the only case of optical simultaneous counterpart known so far, this was the famous ROTSI detection of an optical flash detected simultaneous with the Beppo-Sachs detection of high energy emission from a gamma ray burst. This was the case of 23 January 1999. There was a bright gamma ray burst detected by Beppo-Sachs. The position was immediately relayed. The burst was detected by Bazzi as well, and Bazzi relayed immediately the position to the ROTSI telescope. The precision of the Beppo-Sachs localization allowed the ROTSI astronomers to locate immediately the flash, the optical flash, these three points here. And as you see, they are correlated with the gamma ray light curve, but with a delay, of some couple of tens of seconds. And it's very different from this case on the top. Here is within the measurement errors, it's simultaneous. The optical emission is simultaneous with the gamma rays. So this led to the theorists to different interpretations of the optical prompt emission. In this case, it's reverse shock. It's a shock propagating with slower velocity down the jet with respect to the high energy emission. So that reverse, it appears reverse to an observer moving, co-moving with the plasma. And in this case, since the two light curves are correlated with zero lag, it is thought that both gamma rays and optical come from the same emission mechanism, internal shock. Okay, this is a collection. This is to show, I don't expect anybody to read this figure in detail. It is just to show how many gamma ray bursts SWIFT has allowed the robotic telescope astronomers to follow up the optical prompt counterparts efficiently. Prior to SWIFT, there were just three cases, and then SWIFT has increased the statistics of these optical prompt counterparts very much. This is the short GRB I promised to show. This is the localization. The green and blue circles are localizations, XRT localizations of a short gamma ray burst at different epochs. Probably the green one is the preliminary error box, and the blue one is the final error box. So the gamma ray burst, the short gamma ray burst, must be somewhere within the blue error box, and the blue error box is bordering with this big elliptical galaxy, and it has been assumed that this is the host galaxy of the gamma ray burst, in which case the gamma ray burst is very 0.2 redshift 0.2. There is no optical counterpart for this short gamma ray burst. There is just the X-ray counterpart. This is the first X-ray light curve of a counterpart of short gamma ray burst. This is from Neil Gehrer's Nature paper. The nice thing was the observation that X-ray afterglows of short bursts behave nearly very similar to the afterglows of long gamma ray bursts, meaning that the emission mechanism is the same, is external shock interaction between the relativistic shock with the external medium. And okay, this is a comparison of the light curve of this gamma ray burst with other transients, with supernova, other gamma ray bursts, and supernovae. It is very similar to. It is not dissimilar to the behavior of these other X-ray transients. Okay, this is one of the most important questions about gamma ray, about short gamma ray bursts was, of course, if they are accompanied as well by supernovae. And being this one, the first one detected at so low redshift, the search was supposed to be rather easy. And in fact, an optical counterpart, an optical supernova, has been searched and not found to very tight limits. So it appears that if a supernova is underlying short gamma ray bursts, it must be a very, very underluminous one, orders of three or four orders of magnitudes less bright than normally supernovae are. So probably a supernova is ruled out as a progenitor. This is the afterglow of, this is the first detection, not the first, the detection of the second optical afterglow of short gamma ray bursts, the typical search. The first image shows a point-like source close to a galaxy which has disappeared in the second observation. And here is the residual point source indicating a variable, the presence of a transient. And this is particularly interesting because this is the host galaxy of the previous the optical counterpart of the short GRB I've just shown is close to a galaxy, as I've shown. That spectrum of that galaxy have been taken in two positions: a spectrum of the host of the through the center, putting the placing the slits through the center of the galaxy, and on the GRB position, placing the slit on the GRB position, and in both cases in search of lines. And a star formation rate has been determined through these spectra, and it has been found to be extremely low. In fact, it has an upper limit of 3/100ths of solar mass per year, indicating that host galaxies of short GRBs are totally unlike host galaxies of long GRBs. They have star formation rates. Some of them have very low star formation rates. Not all of them. There are cases in which, for example, the burst of 9 July this year, last year, 2005, has been found in a star-forming galaxy. So the observation is that generally all long GRBs are hosted by star-forming galaxies, and some hosts of short GRBs are star-forming, but some short GRBs host galaxies are elliptical, not star forming. So this is my summary. The statistics is now of detection of GRB localization and afterglow detection is about 200 objects, among which short GRBs are a tiny fraction. We hope an increasing fraction. Redshifts are known for about 70 gamma ray bursts so far. Long GRBs have hosts with intense star formation and low metallicity, and they are likely all associated with with hypernovae. The afterglows of short GRBs are very similar. Both the X-ray and optical afterglows of short GRBs are very similar to those of long GRBs, and their redshifts are usually lower. And most of them are usually hosted by low star formation, by galaxies with low star formation. The short GRBs are not related to supernovae. So the hypothesis, the most accredited hypothesis, is the merger of compact stars, neutron star mergers. And we are still searching for a unified scenario. We are trying to determine, to establish the conditions of a unified scenario for gamma ray bursts and supernovae, or gamma ray bursts and hypernovae. So this is, I will stop here.
Thank you very much.